Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator. And our next guest is Elaine Castle. She's an attorney and professor of law at Concord and Marymount Universities. She's the chair of the American Bar Association's Behavioral Sciences Committee of the Science and Technology Law Section. Interesting. And she's the author of the new book coming out this summer. It's called The War on Civil Liberties, How Bush and Ashcroft Have Dismantled the Bill of Rights. She also writes for Fine Law and has a blog called Civil Liberties Watch. Welcome to the show. It's an honor to have you here, Ms. Castle.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, should I call you Mrs. Castle or Ms.?
You call me Elaine would be nice.
I will call you Elaine, then. That's good.
Okay.
Okay. If it's okay with you, I just want to flip through my handy little pocket constitution that I have here. I wanted to share with the people a little bit of background before we really get started.
All right.
So here we are, Article 1, Section 9. Where'd it go? Oh, here we are. The privilege, yes, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 2. The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when, in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it. And that's from Article 1, the powers of the Congress, not the powers of the President.
All right.
And now I want to, skip to the Fifth Amendment. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. And I just wanted to get that out in the air. And this is the very basic rule of law that all other laws in America are based on. So, again, welcome to the show, Elaine. I was looking through the Internet, reading the news, and I saw lots of articles that said the Supreme Court has dealt a major blow to the Bush administration. And I thought, wait a minute, the Supreme Court that I know and love? I'm not so sure about that. I wonder, and of course I went to antiwar.com, and on their more news section they had something to the effect of Don't Bet on It by Elaine Castle. And boy, was I surprised at the difference between what you wrote about this case and what I read in the New York Times. Why is that?
Well, I don't know. There are probably several reasons for it. The first is that I've been following all the cases through the court since the, quote, war on terror was declared shortly after September 11th. And so I'm, you know, intimately involved with the cases and the decisions. And I've been following the Supreme Court for many years. And a lot of people don't understand what the Supreme Court ruled, and I think that many of the people who wrote about it didn't either. I think that a lot of people haven't read the cases, and so I urge your readers to read the cases. They're easily found. So I think that that's a major difference, that people have misread the cases or they've not read the cases. I've been following the trends of the court. I know what appeared to be, on first blush, a win. If you read further in, you'll see that there's a lot left unsettled, and there's a lot of wiggle room left for the executive branch of the government. And you'll certainly see that if you read the Hamdi and the Guantanamo detainee cases, particularly the Hamdi case.
Well, let's start with the Padilla case, because I think this will be the shortest to deal with.
Yeah.
First of all, this guy, Jose Padilla, he's born in Chicago. He's an American. And he was arrested getting off a plane in New York City. And the Justice Department promptly turned him over to the military, calling him an al-Qaeda terrorist, a dirty bomber. He was going to set off a radioactive bomb, they said.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's been sitting in a brig in belonging to the United States Navy since, 2.5 years ago or so, 2 years ago.
Yeah, about 2 years.
In South Carolina. And he's not had access to a lawyer this whole time. And what did the court do with this case? I'm kind of confused because, well, I don't know. First of all, I was amazed that Scalia, who I always considered the number one enemy of liberty, at least in the judicial branch, he actually said, hey, either charge this guy with treason in court or have the Congress suspend habeas corpus.
Now, that's what he said in the Hamdi case. So let's go back to the Padilla case.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that was
the Padilla case. Padilla has never been charged with anything. except he's been charged in public by the FBI and John Ashcroft with being a jury bomber, but now they've changed their theory, and they said that he was going to be blowing up apartment buildings. But he's never been charged with a crime. He was arrested and held as a material witness, which is another abuse of law that the Bush administration has used since September 11th, to arrest people that they don't have any reason to charge with a crime, but they lock them up, saying that someday they might need to talk to them about an ongoing investigation. And so that is how he was, quote, detained. And when he was detained on a material witness warrant, the court, federal court in New York, did say that he should get an attorney. The court said that the material witness law could be applied to him, but he needed to have a lawyer. And so as soon as his lawyer was appointed, Donna Newman, the military, literally in the dark of night, Donald Rumsfeld appealed to, or the FBI notified Donald Rumsfeld, and Donald Rumsfeld notified George Bush, and they declared Padilla an enemy combatant. Now, an enemy combatant is a term that has been created by the Bush administration. It does not exist anywhere in international law or in the law of war. You do have categories called lawful combatants and unlawful combatants. Lawful combatants are people who are, as you read in the Fifth Amendment, people who are actually, you know, in uniform and fighting a war. Unlawful combatants are people who are not in uniform, maybe not representing the country's military, but who might be acting as saboteurs. In one of the famous cases from the Supreme Court, called the Quirin case, Q-U-I-R-N, had to do with, quote, Nazi saboteurs who were trying to infiltrate the United States. But there's no such term as enemy combatant except as created by George Bush. So he was taken out of the Manhattan Detention Center without knowledge of either the judge in New York or his lawyer and taken to the brig in South Carolina, having been declared an enemy combatant. And since that time, he was denied access to his lawyer. Until right before the Supreme Court was going to hear his case, and Donald Rumsfeld said to his lawyer, okay, you can go to Charleston and see him, but we will videotape and audiotape everything that you do with your client. So, as she said, she didn't have much to do with him. Now, what happened in the case is that the federal government said that his lawyer sued in the wrong court because he was not being detained by Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush, but he was being detained by the warden of the brig in South Carolina.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry, I'm confused. Is the warden of the brig not in the United States Navy?
Yeah, and is she not answerable to Donald Rumsfeld, right?
Seems pretty clear to me.
Yeah, you would think. And so, but here was the reason why. Let me just go on here. What happened was, once he was declared an enemy combatant, and denied access, his lawyer appealed the declaration of enemy combatant to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York State. And that federal court said, release him or charge him. All right? That was then appealed by the U.S. by the U.S. government. But what the U.S. government said, both in the appellate court in New York and in the Supreme Court, was, you're in the wrong court. You need to be in the Fourth Circuit. Now, the reason why the government wanted them to be in the court in the Fourth Circuit, that's in Virginia. That's my home court. And that is the court that gave us the Hamdi case that gave all power to the president. The appellate court in the Fourth Circuit said, whatever the president wants in a time of war, the president gets. And so that was why the court wanted the Padilla case. I mean, the government wanted the Padilla case.
Isn't that a James Madison quote?
Yeah, whatever he wants, he can have.
Yeah.
So what the Supreme Court said, and I was disappointed because I thought that the Padilla case was the most important case because it was an American who was captured on American soil with some vague allegations that have changed considerably as to what the government allegedly has done. Has not been charged with any crime, however, and a little aside here, if you recall, about a month ago, before the Supreme Court handed down its decision, the U.S. attorney, the number two person in the Justice Department, said, this is what Padilla was really going to do, and people feel, and they talked about blowing up apartment buildings, people feel that was done to try to influence the Supreme Court's opinion. Then, the Justice Department said, now, we're never going to charge Mr. Padilla with this crime. You know why? Because he's been locked up for 2 years without a lawyer, and we've got all this information without his having a lawyer. So we have violated his rights. Now, do you feel like you're Alice in Wonderland and falling down the rabbit hole?
I'm sorry.
I do.
To.
I do, because, I mean, here's the government. Here's the government who says we don't have any rights. And so you take Padilla, probably torture him, right? We know, you know, and interrogate him for 2 years, then come out in public and say, this is what he did, but never charge him with a crime, never give him the opportunity to answer for, and you know, to answer to the allegations. So Padilla now, his lawyer last week, started over in Charleston, and it will probably take a year and a half or more for it to get back to the Supreme Court. That was a really dirty thing for the Supreme Court to do, and that was one of the main reasons why I don't feel so optimistic about the cases, because that was the most important case.
Well, and you said in your article that the lawyer in New York, she had filed her writ of habeas corpus in New York before they moved him to South Carolina.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So she filed in the proper court at the time. Now
absolutely.
That they filed in South Carolina, you're saying that they could just move him to Hawaii or something?
Absolutely they could.
Oh, my
absolutely
God.
They could. They could absolutely do that. Now, I bet they probably won't, because they would be so criticized for it. But, of course, you know, his attorney anticipates that they might do that, though. And so, however, as far as the government, they couldn't be in a better court than Richmond, because they will probably lose. The government will probably win first round, you know, in Richmond, but I imagine. And the other thing that will be tested then is this material witness warrant, you see, because he's not been charged with anything. He is unlike Hamdi, who is alleged to have been fighting against the United States in Afghanistan.
Well, and he hasn't been able to dispute that, right?
Oh, no one's been able to dispute anything. That's the only thing that you can do in a habeas corpus petition, by the way, so let's just sort of talk about what that is. In a writ of habeas corpus, which is an ancient, you know, writ that's been established in England in the 13th century to counter the abuses of the kings of England, You have the right to argue that your detention is unlawful. There's no legal basis for your detention. It's used in a lot of cases. You'll hear it used in last minute, say, death penalty appeals. When all else fails and you're trying to allege that the death penalty is cruel and unusual or something like that. But all habeas corpus allows you to do is to try to disprove the government. So, in effect, the burden is on you. No, not in effect, in reality. The burden is on you to prove your innocence or to prove that your detention is unlawful. Not necessarily your innocence, but that your detention is unlawful or that the death penalty is cruel and unusual or that you should not be deported after the government has ordered a deportation order. So a habeas corpus hearing is very difficult for the petitioner to meet, because the government only has to say, this is why we're deporting you. You were arrested for smoking marijuana 10 years ago. Okay? Now, is there a reason why we shouldn't deport you? Well, was that arrest valid? Did I really do it? You have the wrong guy? Those kind of things. But the burden is on the petitioner to prove that they've done nothing wrong. And mention now Hamdi now. Hamdi will have the right to have a habeas corpus petition. But Hamdi's going to have to prove that he was not, that when he was captured in Afghanistan, he was not preparing to fight or doing anything against the United States interest. Now,
and then if the court just dismissed the habeas corpus claim, then he would just go back to the custody of the military again?
Right, yeah. And so Hamdi,
it's sort of like
is,
no big deal that they got their habeas corpus.
Hamdi's going to have his day in court. He's going to have the right to challenge his detention. His detention is based on the fact, now let's say why that is. What is the legal basis for his detention? His detention is potentially lawful because the government gave the president a blanket war powers to fight Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan. And it said use all reasonable force against any person, you know,
well,
any
actually,
who's
though,
fighting.
That would only apply to the Al-Qaeda. That wouldn't apply to the Taliban. They didn't mention the word Taliban or the government of Afghanistan anywhere in that resolution.
It's oh, it's not in that resolution? Okay.
So it's that.
Well, I think there are, okay, that might be an arguable point. Now, what Hamdi's going to have to do is to show that whatever he was doing in Afghanistan, he wasn't doing anything against the United States. Now, how is he going to do that? Well, typically you're going to do that with witnesses. I mean, it's not going to be enough for you to say, I was working for the Red Cross giving out Band-Aids, or I was working for, you know, the Baptist Church as a missionary. So what? It's got your word against the government. And so typically you would imagine that there would be witnesses. Now, where are you going to get witnesses? How are your witnesses, say, from Afghanistan or wherever, how are they going to get into a United States court to testify for you?
So
are they going to be, are they gonna be given visas?
If you had been the majority opinion writer on the court, what would you have done?
For Hamdi?
Yeah, but, I mean, besides just...
Well, I think that's all you could have done, because that's what he asked for. Hamdi asked for the right to challenge his detention, which is about all you could do. Now, the interesting thing was, even though his lawyers didn't ask for it, Scalia and Justice Stevens, an odd, you know, partnership, said, try him for treason. Try him for the crime of treason or release him. Because Scalia was almost, even though he didn't say this, challenging this whole idea of enemy combatants, which I thought was interesting.
Well, his that's
attorney,
really what the court should have done here. If
well,
they
his attorneys didn't ask for that.
Oh, I see. So they couldn't even.
So you see, you can only do what your attorneys asked for, and your attorney, the attorneys asked conservatively, and I know his lead attorney, Frank Dunham, asked for the ability to disprove the claims of the government, which are just an affidavit of someone in the Pentagon based upon something somebody told him, or based on nothing, who knows. But that's all, that's what he's going to get. So now, he's going to have to show that he was not doing anything against the United States' interests in Afghanistan. That's his burden. I think it's going to be a large burden without witnesses. He may have them. But that's what he gets.
Why
yeah,
did John
that,
Walker Lind
now,
get a trial? If John Walker Lind is pretty much the same case as Hamdi, right?
Well, yeah, actually, it's true. The thing is that Lind, we don't know, because Lind talked. Now, the subject of his talking, that's a whole other story, which I write about in my book. Lynn had talked to CNN, and he had talked to CIA and FBI agents, even though they may have violated his Miranda rights, but let's leave that aside. He talked. Now, he said he was over there studying, that he didn't know, you know, anybody was shooting, but there was enough, the fact that he was there, to charge him with aiding and abetting terrorism. I mean, because he was there, we know he was there. We saw him there. He was captured there. He talked and said, though I might have been in this camp, but that's not what I was doing. And so he was brought here and tried. And, of course, he pled guilty and got 20 years, but he did not plead to fighting against the United States.
So there's really nothing different about his case in the law. It's simply the whim of the executive branch decided that way in this case?
Well, Hamdi has not been charged with a crime. Hamdi has only been declared an enemy combatant. Hamdi has not been charged with any crime. Now, let's go a little and confuse the issue a little bit more.
All right.
Whenever you're, the whole idea of being charged with an enemy combatant, I mean, making this category up, and let's just talk about the real categories, lawful and unlawful combatants. Lawful and unlawful combatants get military tribunals under Geneva Conventions and other rules of war, okay? So what the United States is doing and what they say they're going to do in Guantanamo is have military tribunals against the enemy combatants that they picked up, you know, all over the world, but mostly Pakistan and Afghanistan, and are being held in Guantanamo. That is not at all the same thing as challenging your detention in a civil proceeding under a writ of habeas corpus. Okay? The government's trying to speed up these tribunals in Guantanamo, which you started reading about the day after the Supreme Court decision. But the Guantanamo attorneys are saying, wait a minute, we're not going there. We're going to a federal court. We're not going to your kangaroo military tribunals down there. Now, the question is, the interesting question is, for their lawyers, maybe the military tribunals would be better than a petition for habeas corpus.
Why?
I don't know. Well, because the military tribunals will be run more like a trial where they are going to bring in witnesses and prove that the person is an enemy combatant. And
do both, though? Why not try for the writ of habeas corpus first, and then if that doesn't work, go for
I don't know. I mean, I'm saying that is an unanswered question that I have not talked to the lawyers about. Not sure. I know that's in their minds because, it does give one, even though, you know, sometimes we think that the military system of justice is very harsh. It is, but it's also, there's a lot of good things about it, you know. In a military tribunal, there'll be more than one person who will make the decision. Usually it's three or four people. In a writ of habeas, one judge. And again, there'll be witnesses. So who knows where the better venue will be? I think that's an interesting case. Those people and Hamdi are charged with fighting against the United States. But that is not, in and of itself, a crime.
Right. If they're prisoners of war, we'd have to turn them over after the war's over.
It's a very interesting. It's a very interesting dilemma here. And I bet they wish now that they had charged Hamdi, who is an American citizen, with aiding and abetting terrorism. But he's not been charged with a crime. And neither has Padilla. None of these people have been charged with a crime.
Well, the government's argument... Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, therefore, the whole issue of habeas corpus is the right one at the present, because, going back to what Scalia said, try him for treason or let him go, his lawyer, could not really have invited a charge of treason. Treason's very hard to prove anyway, but... that's the interesting thing about these three cases, Guantanamo, Padilla, Hamdi. None of these people have ever been charged with a crime. Now, why was that not such a great thing that the Supreme, from my standpoint, that the Supreme Court said that Guantanamo detainees and Hamdi get to, try to challenge their detention? They get an opportunity to say the government might be wrong. Well, thank you very much, right? Well, because the government, the executive branch's, President Bush's reach of power was so ridiculously lawless, right? Make up the category to start with, enemy combatant, and then say, and no court can challenge me.
Right.
Well, now that is preposterous.
Even better, his argument was, because the Guantanamo Bay, the land of the daily suicide,
that was absurd.
It's not his jurisdiction.
Really sick. And the Supreme Court made quick work of that argument by saying, whenever you're being detained, it's the person who's detaining you, not where you are. Ah, but why didn't they argue? Why didn't that work for Padilla? You might ask, right?
Right.
You see inconsistency there, isn't it? Well, in the Guantanamo case, they only meant that it was the United States government that was holding him, and that wherever the person may be in the detention of the United States, that is where they are then in the jurisdiction of an American court. So that's very interesting too. But of course, keep in mind that will only be as good as the facts there in Guantanamo. But that was a stupid argument. So, you see, the Bush administration has done stupid things. The treaty by which we rent to Guantanamo naval base from Cuba says that we have sovereignty over that. That was a stupid thing to say. For anybody to say, for any president to say, I can do whatever I want to and no court can even consider what I've done. Well, my God, that is so contrary to the Constitution and the rule of law in this country. But of course, the Supreme Court had to say it. Now, the bad thing is that the Fourth Circuit didn't say it. The Fourth Circuit said, "Yep, you're right, Bush. Anything you want, you can have." But the fact that the Supreme Court did what one would pray the Supreme Court would do, and that is say, "Duh." There's another branch of government here, and we're a co-equal branch, right? That doesn't, I mean, to me, that doesn't get them any award.
There's also the question of who exactly is at Guantanamo. They've let over 140-something people go so far, and
right.
Now they're going to release a bunch more before they get their writ of habeas corpus
turned in. Interesting, isn't it? And
but
so
I thought
why
these were
they
the worst of the worst. These are the leadership of Al-Qaeda that we have to be protected from at all costs, rule of law or anything else.
That's what Ted Rumsfeld has said consistently. And so now they're going to let him go. So you see, of course, we know the truth. We know that they rounded up a bunch of people. They wanted to make a big show. They've tortured these people for almost 3 years. These people have been here. And now it's a huge embarrassment. They've gotten their comeuppance from the Supreme Court. The Abu Ghraib situation broke. The guy who ran Abu Ghraib brought his tactics from Guantanamo. People have started to say, talk a little bit about Guantanamo, and we know it's a terrible embarrassment.
Even Peter Jennings did like an hour-long special, and I'm saying, you know, if Peter Jennings doesn't support the state and what it's doing, something is terrible.
Right,
wrong.
Well, yeah.
He loves the state.
And he loves, right, and the mainstream. Once they start to challenge, and of course it's inescapable. I mean, there's almost no one that I know. Even the most conservative of lawyers and people who talk on, you know, some of the good, you know, like NPR and CBS.
Well, and you live in Rome, right? We're out here way over in the center of Texas, but
I live right there. Nobody, even the most pro-Bush spokespeople, I mean outside the government, think that Abu Ghraib was excusable. Or think that holding people 3 years is excusable. Even the guy who wrote the Patriot Act, Viet Dinh, you know, who teaches constitutional law at Georgetown, he thinks everybody ought to have a lawyer. And so the Bush administration has just gone, you know, stupidly off the chart.
My God,
and
the guy that wrote the Patriot Act is against them?
Yeah.
Did they think they were going to get away
with
this?
I think so, because they're just incredibly arrogant. I mean, it seems to me that they think that they... And when you think about it, they have gotten away with it for 3 years, and this is still not over yet. I mean, who knows how long it will be before anybody gets hearings and everybody really gets out of there. So, look, you have achieved your purpose. You've exerted power for 3 years, unbridled, and probably be able to drag it out a little bit longer. I know that they're putting strict rules on the lawyers who are going in to visit their clients down in Guantanamo. So, I don't think this thing is over yet. And then, I think when people get hearings, when the Guantanamo detainees get hearings, I don't think it's going to be any easy for them to prove that they ought to be let go. Maybe Rumsfeld will preempt that and send them home. I just don't think it's going to be easy because petitions for habeas corpus are, as I said, the burden is on the detainee to prove that their detention is wrong. So that's a huge burden when the government has all the evidence it wants to manufacture against you.
All right, well, tell us a little bit about your book, The War on Civil Liberties, How Bush and Ashcroft Have Dismantled the Bill of Rights. I think I have a pretty good idea of the flavor of it, but...
It touches
on more than just this, right?
The book starts with a chapter about the prior laws that made the Patriot Act, sort of paved the way for the Patriot Act, and it talks about the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Act, which really is, in many respects, worse than the Patriot Act.
Ooh, the next time I interview, it's going to be about the Department of Homeland Security.
No, people aren't paying attention to that disaster.
Hey, they used it took 9 months after September 11th before anybody in the media asked the question of who knew what before it happened. And then when they did, they used all that outcry as pressure to create the Department of Homeland Security, which had only been an office before. And then now that the September 11th commission is coming out with who knew what, they're going to use this as the pressure to create their new British-modeled MI5.
Right. Well, remember that Bush was against it. You know, and against the idea of a Homeland Security Department, and the Democrats had recommended it, even Lieberman, I think. And then when he realized what an awesome power grab it would be, which it is, oh my Lord, I mean, and the powers given to all these agencies in the Department of Homeland Security, that's a far worse than the money spent is far worse than the Patriot Act, I believe. So anyway, I talk about the laws, and then I talk about the cases. The most important cases, the terrorist cell cases, the cases against so-called terrorists. I talk about the lawyer's case of Lynn Stewart, who's on trial now in New York. I talk about another lawyer, Jessalyn Raddick, who blew the whistle on Ashcroft on the Justice Department in the John Walker Lynn case. And that's the reason probably why John Walker Lynn ended up pleading and the government didn't take it to trial. I talk about the treatment of the roundup of Muslims after September 11th. In fact, some of them are still being detained and being deported. None of them, the thousands that were detained and the hundreds that were arrested for months at a time, were never convicted of any crime. Many were deported for minor visa violations, some of which happened 20 years ago. Then I talk about the shutdown of the Muslim charities, no crimes, no connections of terrorism ever proven against the charities or their directors, but again, the government only doesn't have to. The laws, the Homeland Security laws and the Treasury laws are so strict, they can just freeze their assets and, in effect, put them out of business. And then find minor visa violations to convict directors of and then ship them home. Then I talk about the resistance movement, the building resistance movement, which is basically local. There are more than 300 counties, cities, and a couple of states that have enacted resolutions against the Patriot Act. And then I try to look into the future, see where we're going to go from here with this madness and this war on terror, which by its very terms can never end. This terrorism is a tactic, you know, so it's never going to end. And as long as people buy the line that we're in a war with terror, and therefore our liberties have to be curtailed, all this hoopla about watch what you're doing this 4th of July, John Ashcroft said, get this, there's a 75% chance that Al-Qaeda might strike on the 4th of July. But we don't know where or when, right, or where, but watch it. And I heard
it makes you wonder how he crunched those numbers.
And listen to this. I just heard these suggestions about if you see somebody carrying a backpack that looks too heavy, they might have a bomb in there, so you better report them. If you see anybody carrying luggage and it's in a place where you shouldn't have luggage, I mean, all these absurd, you know, again, scare the people, keep everybody on their toes, everybody quaking.
Well, one thing about that tactic is we get so desensitized that, you know, scared of terrorists, whatever.
Oh, you're sick of it.
Oh, they're going to blow up a school or the Golden Gate Bridge or they're going to shoot a poison pen at you or whatever.
Or a shopping mall. A shopping mall. But the money that's being spent, listen, I read something this morning, you know, like this, that the Homeland Security Department has given $20 million to some trucking association.
Oh, the Highway Watch.
To train truckers. You see that? To train truckers to look for terrorists.
Yep.
$20 million.
And they said it was in Time Magazine, and they said that...
Oh, that's correct. It was.
The truckers were saying... you can tell an Arab by the turban on his head.
Yes, right.
And meanwhile, actually, there's lots of religions with turbans on their head that have nothing to do with Islam whatsoever.
Right, yeah. So there's, you know, it's just, that's the book. And the book really, now that I've written the book, I mean, it's almost like the things that are happening today are old news, I mean, to me, because I've been following it for 3 years. But now it's become more common. And so, I just shrug and say, but of course. So in a way, my book is sort of a snapshot of the time leading up to it, and who knows what's going to happen in the future. But I don't think it's going to change much, no matter who the administration is. I don't see these powers, these quote war. You know, it's a tremendous boon to any president to say we're at war, and therefore I can do this. Although Bush does it gleefully. I'm a wartime president, Mike. I'm a wartime president. What president likes to be at war? Well, in this kind of a war, I mean, there's a lot of benefits, right?
Well, because I have to say, you know, you talk about the backlash among the states and the cities against the Patriot Act, and
mm-hmm.
and really, you know, from my point of view, the fact that you're writing this book, I'm kind of thankful that it was George Bush in office if September 11th had to happen, because nobody could be so abruptly arrogant as him. I think that really, you know, a smoother president might have gotten away with it a lot easier than he has.
Well, that's a good point.
Call that an endorsement or anything, but
that's a good point. And I think the thing would be to see you know, we don't know how these cases are going to play out, and we don't know how what's going to happen. I mean, you know, who knows? If something else happens, they keep predicting it strongly enough, so we won't be surprised if it does. I'm a great conspiracy theorist, you know. But you can, you know, make what you want of that. But if something else happens, I think the people, as long as you keep the people primed to make them think that it's your liberty caused September, you know, 11th. That is absurd. I mean, that Ashcroft said if we'd had the Patriot Act, September 11th wouldn't have happened. Totally absurd. If the people hadn't been here on, you know, never, I don't need to go into all that.
Right.
Everybody should go to the website of the September 11th Commission and read those factual statements, those staff statements.
Ooh,
they
and you know
are
what's
awesome.
Really fun besides
awesome.
That, too, is the questions of the Family Steering Committee, the questions
oh,
that
yes,
were never
right,
asked by
yes,
the commission
absolutely.
Itself.
Right.
Oh, boy. Hey, I know you got to go. I won't keep
I
you
do.
Too much longer, but
I hope
have
I,
to ask
yeah.
you, for people who don't want to wait till your book comes out and they want to go and read what you write right now,
mm-hmm.
where do they go?
Well, you can go to citypages.com and click on weblogs. And then click on, you know, my name, Elaine Castle, or Civil Liberties Watch, or just go to Google and type in Civil Liberties Watch, and you'll find the page.
Okay.
Also have a lot of articles on fine law, but Civil Liberties Watch, type it into Google, and up it will pop. I have a lot of good articles on there.
Good deal. And for anybody who missed that, I'll have the link up on my site in a couple of days.
Great.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been awesome. Happy Independence Day to you.
Yeah, yeah. So I hope we have something to celebrate.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Come back sometime soon.
Uh-huh. I will. Bye.